It is Monday, January the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, crisis after crisis in the Middle East.
There is a very serious and dangerous situation right now in the Middle East. You have a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran in all over the Middle East. And to be more precise, it's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and several Arab allies.
Also ahead, Egyptian parliament meeting after three-year lapse, global warming and El Nino combining for some bad, bad weather, plus saying goodbye to an R&B gospel legend. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The U.N. Special Envoy to Syria met with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Tehran on Sunday, describing the discussions as useful ahead of upcoming peace talks later this month. Last week, Stefan de Mistura met with Syrian opposition officials in Saudi Arabia, which supports Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's opponents, and on Saturday he met with officials in Damascus, which announced it was ready to attend the talks but wants to make sure that no terrorist groups would be represented. De Mistura said Sunday that Iran had assured him that its diplomatic row with rival Saudi Arabia would not affect the Syrian peace talks. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Indiana University scholar Abdulkader Sino if those talks remain on track.
The talks will be on track, but they will also not have good odds to succeed, just like they did before, because the opposition is incredibly fragmented in Syria, and there are many spoilers, and the regime itself would rather gain time, because time is working in its favor right now. So they all will play along. They will all go through the movements and pretend, you know, to be part of serious negotiations, but nothing serious will probably happen.
There was a member of the opposition called the Islam Army, or Jaish al-Islam, that expressed misgivings about the talk, citing the need to see something of a goodwill measure from the government of Damascus, including a ceasefire, detainee release, and the end of blockades on besieged areas. Do you think that's possible?
It will not happen, but they are very right to request that. Listen, there are seven areas in Syria, regions in Syria, that are under blockade by the government, that including Madaya, which is a city that's now heavily covered, militarized, and where you have people undergoing famine because the regime would not allow food to go in. It's brutal. You have 40,000 people in this one enclave, and you have seven of those enclaves in Syria right now. Of course, the opposition wants some relief for the population in their areas, and it's a legitimate request. But the regime, of course, will also not accept, because now it has advantage on the ground with the Russian support, the Hezbollah support, the Iranian support. And so it would be bidding for time to make more gains before it would enter serious negotiations.
Well, Damascus told Mr. de Mistura on Saturday that it was prepared to take part in the Geneva talks, but said that there's a need to see the names of the Syrian opposition figures who will take part. Will they not take part if certain names are there?
Well, I mean, that provides them an opportunity to bow out if they need to. The thing is with that regime is that it calls most of the opposition groups terrorists. There's no acceptable, very few acceptable opposition groups for the regime anyway. So for them, that's a way to scuttle the talks whenever they want to and not to hold themselves responsible. It's a preemptive measure.
There was also a meeting of Arab foreign ministers in Cairo, as you know, the Arab League, and they condemned Sunday a statement that they called Iran's meddling in Arab affairs. Will this complicate matters to ease the concerns between the Shia and Sunni worlds?
Yes. I mean, there is a very serious and dangerous situation right now in the Middle East. You have a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran in all over the Middle East. And to be more precise, it's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and several Arab allies of that country, you know, from Egypt to the small Gulf states against Iran. And on one side, Iran on the other side. And they are both just as guilty as the other in terms of transgressing on human rights in the region and in using proxies to attack people from other groups. And the trick now is to be able to reduce tensions. And In fact, this may be an opportunity for the United States, which has little interest in seeing those tensions become even more salient and more dangerous, to perhaps play the role of mediator between two countries, between which it never had the opportunity to play the role of mediator. But now, with the nuclear agreement, who knows? Maybe that's an opportunity for the U.S. and for Mr. Kerry, perhaps, to gain more leverage with the Iranian state, something it's never had before, and perhaps shift public opinion in Iran vis-a-vis the United States.
That's Abdelkader Sino. He is a Middle East Studies scholar at Indiana University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. You know, you can stay on top of the news out of the Middle East at our website. That's voanews.com.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
This is VOA's International Edition. Egypt held an opening session of Parliament on Sunday, the chamber's first session in more than 3 years. Egypt had not had a parliament since 2012 when a court dissolved the democratically elected legislature that had been dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood of the country's former president, Mohamed Morsi. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, now the president, is the former head of Egypt's armed forces. He rose to power in 2014 after a military coup toppled Morsi and led to his eventual arrest and the Muslim Brotherhood being outlawed. Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front Party has warned its members that it is the prerogative of the incumbent president, Edgar Lungu, to choose his vice presidential running mate before the August 11th presidential and legislative elections. But the Patriotic Front says it is not against party members who aspire to higher position, including becoming the vice presidential nominee, to partner with Lungu. Some of the aspiring candidates had threatened to quit the party if they're not chosen to be the vice presidential candidate. Patriotic Front warned members not to engage in acts that could divide the party. Also in the news, a long-range U.S. B-52 bomber flew over South Korea Sunday in an apparent response to North Korea over its latest nuclear weapons test. VOA asked Korea expert Tony Stangarone of the Korea Economic Institute of America if the B-52 flyover was the right thing for the U.S. to do.
I think this is an appropriate response. What we've done is we've essentially taken and demonstrated to North Korea that we do remain committed to the defense of both South Korea and Japan, and that we have the means with which to take and defend them should North Korea decide to utilize its growing nuclear program for an attempt to take and either cause provocations on the peninsula or some other type of disruption to either South Korea or Japan.
Sunday's flight of the B-52 came hours after North Korean leader Kim Jong-un defended his last Wednesday's test of an alleged hydrogen bomb as a demonstration of what he called self-defense against the U.S.-led imperialist. Stangarone's read on Kim's rhetoric.
It tends to be something that demonstrates perhaps what they need internally for domestic consumption, but doesn't reflect necessarily the situation on the ground. We all know that the greatest danger of a nuclear conflict taking place is from North Korea's own nuclear program. If you look at the United States, South Korea, and Japan, they've all taken and sought to engage the North in some way over the past years. But despite efforts to take and reach out to discuss the nuclear program, South Korea's efforts through its Trust Politique program to build greater economic and cultural ties, Japan's efforts through the Abe administration over the last couple of years to try and resolve the abductee issue with North Korea, in all these situations, North Korea has both turned its back on these efforts and continued to take and push this program forward. So I think the real threat, as we all understand, is North Korea's own nuclear program and not the United States or South Korea.
North Korea's nuclear test angered traditional ally China, set off a firestorm of criticism in capitals across much of the world. Last week, President Obama announced a series of new measures meant to reduce gun violence in America, bypassing Congress on an issue that has sharply divided the public. The executive actions will require more gun buyers to undergo background checks. Mr. Obama speaking at the White House.
We're going to boost gun safety technology. Now, today, many gun injuries and deaths are the result of legal guns that were stolen or misused or discharged accidentally. In 2013 alone, more than 500 people lost their lives to gun accidents, and that includes 30 children younger than 5 years old. Now, in the greatest, most technologically advanced nation on Earth, there is no reason for this. We need to develop new technologies that make guns safer. If we can set it up so you can't unlock your phone unless you got the right fingerprint, why can't we do the same thing for our guns?
Republicans who generally oppose gun control measures reacted angrily to the president's proposals, saying they represent an outreach of his, an overreach, that is, of his authority. Now for some perspective on all of this, International Edition's Ira Melman speaks with Robert Spitzer, a scholar and observer of American politics and culture. Asked about the significance of the gun debate and gun ownership as part of the American culture, Dr. Spitzer had this to say.
There are several reasons why America has this very distinctive gun culture, but let me say at the outset that contrary to the impressions of some people, most Americans today do not own guns, are not interested in guns, and do not participate in the gun culture. And related to that is the fact that gun ownership in America has actually been declining for about the last 40 years or so. Having said that, America does retain a significant gun culture in American society. Americans who own guns, who like guns, who like to use them, either for hunting sporting purposes or for more political purposes. Our tradition of gun ownership is old, to be sure. It goes back to the very earliest days of the country's founding. It is closely identified with how America won its independence from Great Britain in the 1770s, so it has that political and romantic connotation of Americans scooping up their flintlocks and kissing the wife goodbye and going off to fight the British and then coming home in time for lunch. But that tradition is only part of the story. The other part is that Americans have a long tradition of individualism and of anti-government feeling. And among some Americans, the idea of owning guns is a political statement. It's a way for them to assert their independence, their individualism as they see it. And for some Americans, it's a way to say that I don't need the government, that the government should behave in a way that I think is appropriate, and if it doesn't, why, I might just pick up my gun and use it against the government in some manner.
How does that stack up against the amount of violence that does take place and the number of people killed in the United States by gun violence as compared to other developed countries?
Well, interestingly enough, America's overall crime rates are roughly comparable to the crime rates found in other Western democratic nations. However, guns are much more likely to be used in violent crime and especially in murders. And when you compare America's murder rate to the murder rate in every other Western democratic nation, Americans' murder rate is many times higher. And that's because of the presence of guns. And when you pick up a gun and you're contemplating an act of violence, the likelihood that somebody will be hurt or killed is far, far greater. And that's because firearms are the most efficient way to hurt and kill other human beings. And it's the presence of guns in such violent situations that rockets America's murder rate far, far higher than that of any other Western democratic nation.
That is Robert Spitzer. He's a professor and chair of political science at State University of New York, and he was speaking with my colleague, Ira Melman. This week, President Obama will deliver his final State of the Union address to the nation and Congress. International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks now with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman about all of this.
We have what could be Congress's version of the prom. It happens every year. members of Congress get all dressed up. They invite their spouses or sometimes a political guest. Mm-hmm. And the president gives a speech. And this is President Obama's final State of the Union address. We don't know exactly what he will say. In fact, he may surprise us, but certain things are probably a good bet. He's likely to mention what he thinks are the prime accomplishments of his administration, and he's likely to try to chart a path forward in an election year.
I suspect that topics of the Middle East and gun control may come up.
Indeed. Members of both parties want to know exactly what the plan is to defeat Islamic State. There's also a growing chorus of legislators of both parties who want to know exactly how the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal is going to go forward, given some of Iran's recent actions. On gun control, I'm going to make a bold prediction, Jim. There is not a single Republican lawmaker who will change his or her standing on gun control based on what the president says.
I think you're absolutely right on that.
And I would extend that to any comments that the president may have on immigration. But on these big global affairs, matters that pertain to national security, I think that there's a real hunger when it comes to learning more about how the United States is going to confront Islamic State and this Iran nuclear deal. And one other thing, we have before Congress the text of a major trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That is VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. You know, a series of weather disasters has shaken the world. That's not news. You know that. Recent weeks, deadly floods in the United States, Britain too, adding to ongoing devastating droughts in Brazil, South Africa, and India. VOA's Michael Lippin examines the causes of the extreme weather with a panel of climate observers in our program, hashtag VOA.
From the American Midwest to Northern Britain, severe storms and flooding have left a path of devastation. Jeff Masters is the director of meteorology at Weather Underground, a U.S. online news service. Speaking on our hashtag VOA TV program via Skype, Masters says global warming is partly to blame because it heats up the world's oceans and sends evaporated water into the atmosphere where it generates more heat.
Now, with a warmer atmosphere, you've got more energy to power bigger storms. So when it does rain, you're going to see more of those high-end societal impactful events.
Global temperatures have been rising for years, but in December 2015, they coincided with the start of an unusually strong El Niño, a natural periodic warming of the eastern Pacific Ocean that can last a year or two. Some climate observers say the combination of global warming and El Niño appears to have caused temperatures at the North Pole to rise briefly above freezing in December, something that's happened only three times since 1948. Robert Finney is the author of Robert Scribbler, a popular U.S. blog about environmental issues. He told hashtag VOA the Arctic heat wave is melting sea ice and creating a feedback effect.
The loss of sea ice turns a white reflective surface to a dark heat-absorbing surface. And so during the summertime, the Arctic Ocean is sucking up a lot more heat from the solar rays. And over time, it re-radiates that heat over the fall and into the winter. And that's a really big impact. That's a new impact that we're seeing.
The Arctic's polar bears live, hunt, and breed on the shrinking ice. Polar Bears International is a U.S. and Canadian nonprofit dedicated to conserving the animals, whose numbers are dropping. The group's chief scientist, Stephen Amstrup, told hashtag VOA via Skype that more of the animals will disappear even if the international community limits global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, as agreed at last month's Paris Climate Conference.
The impacts would be significant, and we would lose polar bears over much of their current range. But it's a lot more than polar bears. People say, well, polar bears live way up north, and why should I care? They're just really harbingers of what's coming to the rest of us.
The climate observers say what's coming in 2016 could be more human losses to extreme weather, as global warming and El Nino continue to fuel each other in the coming months. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
And many thanks to you, Michael. From Washington, this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
You may have heard that dying people have some rather amazing dreams or visions in the final weeks and days of their lives. A new study by researchers at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, suggests that these end-of-life dreams are an important and comforting part of the dying process that improve quality of life for those about to die. While some in the medical community consider these dreams and visions to be no more than delusions or hallucinations, the researchers found that to someone dying, they're quite realistic and often very meaningful. The researchers found that the most common and most comforting theme of these visions and dreams were those of deceased family and friends. The study also showed that these dreams and visions became more frequent the closer a person came to death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Hall of Fame rhythm and blues artist Otis Clay has died of a sudden heart attack. He was 73. Now I'll look back at the life and times of this great entertainer. Born in the U.S. state of Mississippi, Clay made his recording debut in 1965 with this rousing ballad, Flame in Your Heart. Known for his tenor-tinged voice on blues songs and his haunting baritone on gospel standards, Clay had a way with musical expression like none other of his generation.
Through the years, I keep on joining.
One-time Grammy nominee had a year of touring planned behind recent records and recognition at May's 37th Blues Music Awards. Clay, nominated for Soul Blues Male Artist and Soul Blues Album for This Time for Real, his collaboration with Billy Price. But his gospel-inflected music, like When the Gates Swing Open, helped him reach possibly his greatest notoriety. Otis Clay was known internationally as much for his big heart and charitable work as for his singing.
I used to smoke 5 packs of cigarettes a day. It was the hardest thing to put them away. I drank 4 or 5 bottles of wine. I kept a glass in my hand all the time. Oh, breaking those habits was hard to do. Not the
Ray Price once said, music enthusiasts and record collectors worldwide flock to Otis's music because of its unvarnished style wrought in the 60s soul scene in Memphis and Muscle Shoals. Trying to live my life without you is one that fits that bill. Really knows how to sing, doesn't he? Huh? Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. Latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope that you have a super Monday. Now back to the sounds of Otis Clay. It's the hardest burden I'll ever.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Around the world, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Vietnam, Syria, Russia, Iran, and other countries, journalists are under siege and freedom of expression is under threat. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that in 2014, more than 60 journalists were killed, hundreds imprisoned, and dozens remain missing. Reporters Without Borders notes that governmental attempts to silence journalists include censorship, harassment, restrictive NGO laws, and public threats by political leaders. Speaking at Columbia University in New York, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs Richard Stengel, himself a former journalist, described freedom of expression as a foundational human right. Challenges to that freedom, he said, are now deeper and more profound than at any time in decades. He described three: the physical dangers journalists confront in conflict zones and elsewhere, the shrinking space for free expression in countries with autocratic leadership, and the rise of disinformation. In the past, journalists trying to expose the truth were given a kind of safe pass, said Undersecretary Stengel. Now they are targets of regimes and of terrorists like ISIL. As such, supporting freedom of the press is a critical element of U.S. foreign policy. It is one of the issues that our diplomats around the world regularly address in bilateral talks with governments. One initiative provides trainings to journalists on physical and digital security and psychosocial care throughout the world. And the U.S. has invested over $100 million in Internet freedom programs to provide tools and trainings to thousands of vulnerable civil society and independent journalists around the world. Finally, in response to the rise of disinformation from terrorist groups or autocratic regimes, the U.S. is being proactive, said Undersecretary Stengel, in claiming the space for truth-telling by pushing back on propaganda and falsehood with fact-based messages, as well as by supporting independent media around the world with financial, technical, and logistical support. And why? Because, as President Barack Obama has said, journalists give all of us as citizens the chance to know the truth about our countries, ourselves, our governments. That makes us better. It makes us stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.